smoothly connected to simple product states like the free electron state or the Bose condensate of electron pairs. A large stretch of solid state physics can be described by adiabatic continuity of some simple product states. But in the last 20 plus years, we found many examples in the next letter, also here are states that are not of this class. And here's a listing of some of them. And roughly I've classified them according to the nature of the excitations above them. So in gap quantum matter, I mean states which have a gap for an infinite system to all excitations. And for conformal quantum matter, I mean systems like graphene, in a sense, which at low energies has gapless excitations, which have a massless Dirac fermion, a relativistic structure. And finally, compressible quantum matter are, as the name says, sort of like Fermi liquids, which are compressible, can change their density continuously, and have a surface in momentum space of low energy excitations. So it's really a classification by dimensionality of the fraction of momentum space at which there are zero energy excitations. So now for the first two categories, we actually have a fairly good understanding at this point. And that's partly because there is a natural framework to talk about such states. And roughly speaking, you can put many, almost all examples of what gap quantum matter under topological field theory. And similarly, for conformal quantum matter, there is a now well-developed technology of conformal field theory, which also has connections then to spin theory and anti-consider space. But we're really searching for the right paradigm to describe these more interesting states, which also happen to be the states which are probably the most ubiquitous in experiments. Okay, but so one other tool I'm going to use a lot in my discussion is the entanglement entropy. So here's just the definition of what it is. You take the exact ground state of some infinite system, you divide the system into two parts, A and B, you trace over the degrees of freedom of one part of it, so you get a reduced density matrix of region A, and then you compute its entanglement entropy. So this is one of the quantities that you're going to use to diagnose some of these states. Normally, in classical physics, we use symmetry breaking order parameters, but here we need new ideas, and this is just one of the quantities that has been quite useful in recent years. Okay, so let me just quickly review, although it won't be a big part of the main thrust of my talk, but some simple examples of gap quantum matter. So the simplest example is, of course, just a band insulator. It's not a trivial example. It just all states filled and like something like silicon, and it has a gap to all excitations for the rigid lattice. Okay, so in a state like this, if you compute the entanglement entropy, then in two dimensions, you for an appropriately defined limit of system size going to infinity, you'll get an entanglement entropy that grows in the perimeter of region A. And this is simply suggesting that if there's any entanglement, it's just right near the boundary. And corrections that are exponentially small, provided you define this limiting case carefully enough. So that's the kind of a baseline result of a reasonably well understood state. So we want examples that are more complicated than that. So one of the most exciting recent examples actually comes from the Tagore antiferromagnet. So this is a system of electron spins sitting on the Tagore side, where the Coulomb repulsion now prohibits the charge from fluctuating, but the spins are able to rotate. Now, under certain conditions, you could imagine the spins order as shown, but then this is not, again, this takes great symmetry, and it's somehow connected to a simple product state of spins. But we are interested in a more complicated state where the spins are fluctuating. And you might think, well, if you take such a state and have all the spins fluctuate, you get a trivial disordered state, like a liquid at very high temperature of the spins, where all correlations decay exponentially. Well, it is true you can get such a state, but there is a lot of subtle information in that quantum disordered state. And in this case, one candidate state for quantum disorder state is something we call a Z2 spin liquid. And this has some additional quantum information in the structure of the ground state and the structure of the excitations. And in particular, you need the gauge theory to properly describe the spectrum of excitations above the ground state. So let me try to give you a intuitive picture of what this zinc-dependent liquid might be like. So in fact, the picture goes back to an idea of Anderson and others and Pauling a long time ago. So their picture is this RVD picture where you have the electrons forming singlet bonds, but then just like in a benzene ring, where here's a benzene ring, this resonance between different configurations of bonds, but now this resonance extends to the entire lattice. So you get this liquid of resonating valence bonds. That's in fact a more accurate picture of describing this disordered state. So this disordered state, however, still has some structure. And one way to see that structure is to think of these resonating valence bonds as starting from some reference configuration. Pick some reference configuration. And then when you resonate, write that configuration down as a difference from the reference configuration. So in this case, that difference is just around this plaquette, so that's just a closed loop right there. And then you can do that for all the configurations I showed you. And so what you'll see that the ground state there is a sum of many closed loops, in fact, a sum of all the closed loops. So the picture now of the ground state is as a sum of an infinite number of closed loops, and they all in superposition of this very complicated configuration. So if I now want to compute the entanglement entropy, well, sure, the system is disordered, but now there is, if you wish, one bit of order. That one bit of order is that if you go around this perimeter, you always cut an even number of lines. And that's intrinsic to the structure of the state. So as a consequence, when you compute its entanglement entropy, you find there is still a term proportional to the perimeter, the area law, as it's called. But let me call it the perimeter law, the clearer two dimensions. But there is a subtraction corresponding to the bit of information you have, and that for this particular state happens to be wrong in this case. Okay, so one of the exciting recent developments has been this has been measured by some large scale numerical studies of the Kagami antiferromagnet and the axial antiferromagnet that I wrote down. And in two recent papers, these two recent papers, just a month or two ago, they see precisely this log 2 offset in the entanglement, suggesting that this is indeed this type of zinc-dependent liquid, although that's not exclusively found. Even more exciting has been a recent report by Yang Li on this neutron scattering measurements on this particular crystal, which he, for the first time, managed to grow a large enough crystal to have detailed neutron scattering observations. Now, I won't go through the details of this, but this is really very striking evidence that the excitations about this ground state are not spin waves or anything like that, but really made up of convolutions of spin-on or fractionalized excitations that we expect on this type of spin picture. Okay, so I'm sure there's a lot more to be done in this direction, but you know, our understanding is moving along, and we've learned a lot, and now the many things seem to be coming clear, which is very exciting. Okay, so let me turn then to the other second category, which we understand a little less, but not too bad either. So what is conformal quantum matter? So to give you an example of conformal quantum matter, let's take the spin systems, but now let me take this particular Hamiltonian sitting on the square lattice, where the exchange constants now are not uniform, but take two values, g and j over lambda. And let me ask, what's the ground state as a function of lambda? Okay.
So when you compute the entanglement entropy, the Kagome.
Yes.
How do you choose the ground state? Because you said that you have to choose the.
Yeah, so there's a long story I'd rather not go into, and many people in the audience are much better experts at it than I am. But okay. then people have, I think, figured that out. And you can ask people around here who know much better than I do. So that's, and also I should say there were computers of any entropy, not the entanglement. Gifrit can tell you. Roger. Okay. All right, so in this model, there are now two constants, J and J over lambda. And so there's one dimensional parameter, lambda, which I can vary and ask what the ground state looks like. So when lambda is very large, then you just get product of singlet pair because you want to take advantage of a very large bond, the other bond of the weak. And you also know that when lambda is 1, close to 1, then you're going to get this state where the spins behave classically in this form of checkerboard state. The nail state will have to spin up and have to spin down. And from many, many studies, we now know for sure, really, that there is one special value of lambda, which is the critical point of the phase condition between these two states, where you have a conformal field theory described in the low energy limit. So the system itself is sitting on a lattice, but in the low energy limit at this critical point, the theory has not only relativistic invariance, but also conformal invariance. And it's a gapless state, which is described by a certain conformal field theory. In this case, it's the O3 Wilson-Fisher fixed point, which was originally introduced to describe classical physics at finite temperature near the Curie condition in the ferromagnet. Here we have field theory in 2 plus 1 space-time dimension, so one dimension of the original Wilson-Fisher fixed point become time. And so in a two-dimensional system, you have a quantum critical point, which is described by this fixed point, and so this is, CFE3 based on formal field theory, and 3 refers to 2 space and 1 time dimension. Okay, so this critical point is something that also been studied a great deal, but let me just focus on its entanglement entropy. So if you compute its entanglement entropy, that turns out now actually to be quite a difficult task. And there really aren't satisfactory results in general for what this entanglement entropy is. But there's general quite a deal of evidence that, in fact, it's exactly of the same form that was found for the gap quantifier. In particular, you have a term proportional to the perimeter that's non-universal, and then offset is gamma, which is a universal number, meaning it doesn't depend on any short distance physics. In the limit where p becomes very large. Now, in this case, however, this number is much more subtle. Unlike the gap quantum matter case, this number depends on the precise shape of this medium. At least, if it's a circle as opposed to an ellipse, you get different numbers. And some of this is these computations have only been done in some restricted geometries.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
In this 2 plus 1 dimension, is it possible to have a log dependency?
No, as far as not for CFTs.
They've been shown, proven, or something. For every CFT, they cannot be log dependent.
Well, there are some near corners, I think. But I don't know if it's proven.
Yeah, suppose with no corner. Yeah.
With no corners, it's almost certainly true. I don't know if it's been proven.
I heard there are some results using this. This holographic thing.
I think for the case of a circle.
As we said, if holographic, this geometric is not exact, but the correction may give you a lot of this issue.
I think when A is a circle, then you can relate this by a conformal mapping to a partition function on X3, and I think there are some proofs there.
But I see, it is
circle. So it requires conformal invariance, and that's, the hyperscaling property really is the same thing. It's very similar to hyperscaling of free energy near structural fixed points. As long as you have hyperscaling, there won't be any problems in 3 dimensions.
Maybe another related question is that presumably this conformal point have a z equal to 1.
Yes.
So if z not equal to 1, whether one can expect gamma may have a log dependence.
It could if you're in the upper critical dimension. Yeah, it's possible. We don't have any good examples, very few examples of z not equal to 1 and strongly coupled. We don't know only 3 field theories, most of them. But that's not been very studied very much. Okay, but anyway, now that I have a conformal field theory and I have the entanglement entropy, this gives me an excuse to introduce holography. So we need a whole new tool, which has been very powerful to think about such systems. And one way to think about it is just as a natural evolution of the RG that's been so powerful in studies of phase conditions as matter. So the normal way of doing RG is you start with some system, you decimate some degrees of freedom, and you get a new system with new couplings, and then you keep going, and then you look at the flow of couplings. So you can think of holography as something very similar, with two key differences in a way, many differences, but conceptually the key difference is one that you don't, in RG, you start one point, you do the RG, and then you just work at one scale. But in holography, if you don't do that, you keep the entire history, and you work with all scales at the same time. So this is, you have, there's a lot of redundant information, of course. But there's a lot of advantage also of working consistently with all scales. For instance, that allows one to have, you know, long distance physics have a feedback on the short distance physics. And that can happen in any system for many physical properties, that's quite important. But in RG, that never happens. The RG is just a one way flow. But the holography kind of goes beyond RG, that it allows for the IR physics to feedback on the UV physics in some consistent manner. So those are the key difference. You keep all scales and you allow for influence to go both back and forth. And also this approach has a very natural generalization to real time as opposed to imaginary time. And so it leads very naturally and easily to dissipated physics in real time quantum mechanics. Anyway, so now one other feature of the RG, which is it can view as key to setting up holography too, is locality. That is, if I do an RG from here to here, to figure out the couplings here, I just need to know the couplings there. I don't need to know the couplings way back. So the RG is, you know, the transformation doesn't depend on what scale you're at. So that might suggest that if I now keep the entire history, that I could write down a theory in this extra dimensional space, which has some sense of locality in this direction that I'm going to call r. And I'm going to refer to these directions as x and x1 and x2. Okay, so now if you accept this idea, which, you know, sounds completely radical and wasn't accepted until we had examples from string theory where this idea seemed to work, but if you accept it, then you can quite easily figure out what the space should look like for the case of a conformal field theory. So suppose I really had on the boundary, suppose this theory was this system at this point. So I take this point, put it here, and then I ask what does the space look like? Well, at that point, I know my theory of the boundary is scale invariant with x scales with factor zeta and t scales with factor zeta. Now I have some proper distance. This is ds, is a measure of distance in this u space. And let me assume that's invariant. As we'll see, that invariance is actually an assumption, and it corresponds to assuming hyperscalar. But this was implicitly assumed by the string theory without even a thought, but in fact is an assumption. But once you accept these requirements, then there's basically a unique metric that can satisfy this problem. And that's in fact the metric of anti-Lucena space. You just take, you know, some quadratic form of dt, dr, and dx. It can't be any function. It can't have any coefficient dependent on x or t because you have Lorentzian invariant in the boundary. So you can only put in functions of r. And then up to some reparameterization invariance in r, this is the only thing that can do. Okay. And that's precisely then the metric of anti. So that's the lightning derivation of many years of deep work by string theorists. So here's how string theorists would draw it. You have a conformal field theory sitting on the boundary. And this 1 over r squared means space shrinks. And that's the shrinking of space. Now the shrinking of space is just another way of talking about the decimation of the degrees of freedom here. Here we're keeping space fixed, but making the lattice space enlarged. And of course, string theorists like to think slightly differently. Here you shrink space itself. It's the same thing, just another frame of reference. So that picture is just, should now look like a very familiar picture, this real space RG. Okay, so I have some theory now on this expanded space. I should have mentioned, because of the redundancy in the degrees of freedom, it's a gauge theory, involves gauge fields and also fluctuating gravity, so in general, quite hard to deal with, but mostly you work in a regime where the gravity theory is really coupled in the hope of describing some strongly coupled theory of the model. Okay, so now let's use this to compute the entanglement entropy. So you take a region A on the boundary, and as I told you, the field theory method is quite a job to compute the entanglement entropy. How do you compute it here? Well, there is a prescription due to Guido and Takinagi, which goes as follows, and then we try to motivate it by the arguments. They said was you take this region A, and then you draw a surface that encloses the region A, and you measure that surface area. Now, so the argument goes as follows. So now once you enclose the region A, you want to suspect the physics of region A in terms of degrees of freedom living inside this expanded region. Now you have traced over everything outside, so you know nothing but what's going outside. So it's as if you have an apparent horizon, like the surface of a black hole, which prohibits you from seeing anything outside. So it suggests that you could associate the entanglement entropy with somehow the entropy of this region of space, space-time, in this holographic space. Now, there's another feature of gravity that many people have talked about over the years, that in any quantum theory of gravity, the maximum amount of entropy that can be contained in any region of space is bounded by its surface area. So if you want to get the best possible bound, you want to take the minimal surface area. And that's the Guido Takinagi formula. You draw a surface area that's minimal, and then that area measures the entanglement. Very simple expression, but it turns out to be extremely powerful. And it was a conjecture at that time, about 6 years ago, and it's passed many, many tests since then. Now, one way you might want to think about this, which is due to Brian Swindle, is by this picture. So this picture perhaps is more familiar to people here. This is a tensor network representation, say, of some quantum system where you start with some quantum degrees of freedom. You do some different transformations and decimations. Then you can think of it as some pictorial representation of a trial wave function for your quantum system. So the degrees of freedom sitting over there. And this axis is just a kind of a fake axis, it's depth of entanglement. Here entangled spins, then McDermott's bond, and McDermott's bonds, and other objects, and so on. And the whole point of this conformal field theory is that you have this levels of entanglement goes forever. So this scalar-bearing structure, it's got entanglement at all scales. Whereas in gap quantum matter, the entanglement stops at some point. So now, if you take this picture, it's very natural to try to, if you want to compute the entanglement entropy, if you associate entangled entropy with these links, Brian argued you should really count the number of links cutting an arbitrary line enclosing region A, and then minimize that number. You'll see if you go way down, then you cut a lot of links because you're going down. If you go cut across here, you cut a lot of links because they're denser. So there is really an optimal path you can take. And so the spirit of this argument then is very similar then to this formula of Guido and Takinagi, where it is to the minimal surface area. And in this argument, and therefore this emergent direction of ABS is nothing but the depth of entanglement. That's another way. Okay. All right. So now, however, for CFT3s, we have this formula. So it's very easy to compute. It's just a simple transverse of variation computation. You give me your shape, and I will just go to ABS4, draw a surface, minimize the surface area, out pops an answer. So if you do that for the case of CFT3s, you indeed get the form that was expected in terms of proportional perimeter and offset, which is a universal number. And universal in the sense that it depends only on IR features of the CFT. And in fact, it's also shape dependent, as you expect. And today, there's actually several checks in theories where you have both the holographic and the field theory resolution of this formula. It works. And another formula I should mention, suppose I do this one dimension lower for CFT2s, which certainly was much better understood. In that case, there's a much older formula of Bolle-Larsen principle check, which said that the entanglement entropy of a central charge over 6 times log p. And the real time PID formula absolutely gives you exactly that. It's the fact of sense and everything. This pops out by drawing the critical length of the optimal curve in AES. Okay. So this law that Shankar mentioned is now appears only even long field theory, it appears in 2 but not 3. And this log violation is an intrinsic script. It's a signature of the 1 plus 1 dimensional nature of one canvas point here. Okay? So that's then completes my lightning summary of the formal field theories and their entanglement properties. Any questions? Okay, so now let's get to the tough part. But this is the easy part. Everyone got this, right? Alright, so let's talk about the part we don't understand, where I'll give you some conjectures of what's going on. So what is compressible quantum matter?
Maybe I have a
question
for the previous one. So there's a C here, and so I believe this argument that can produce is log P.
Yes.
But whether this C can also be calculated using the gravitational sign?
Yes, so okay. Everything has to be done at the level of classical gravity. So if you take the pure gravity theory, it has a Newton's constant and an AES radius. And the ratio, there's a dimensionless combination of them, which is the central term.
Yes.
In other words, if you take the gravity theory and compute T mu correlation function, that's C over Z to the 4. So that fixes C in terms of Newton's constant and the AES radius. So there's a connection between C, Newton's gravitational constant, and the AES radius.
I see.
So you know C. From G and L. And then you just do this computation and you get the same combination.
So this is beyond, this is kind of semi-classical gravity result or beyond the semi-classical gravity?
It's just semi-classical. Everything is classical gravity. But it gives you exactly the right answer.
So the issue is following, in conformal field theory, C always a rational number.
Yeah.
So one may concern that maybe at a semi-classical level you get this rational number C, but when you're introducing actual correction, whether they became a real number. Or
so the C is about an n-squared and n-squared infinity, and it's in the leading n-squared. So in this limit, C is very large. So accurate in C is very large. But it happens to give the exact answer. But, okay. I mean, it's also, for example, you can do more. If I look at correlation functions in the boundary, they can have finite temperatures. You take any CFP2 correlation function, finite temperature, all fixed as ratio of gamma functions, all of that comes out exactly right. Just by solving Einstein's equations, you can reproduce those gamma functions in conformal field theories, which is quite remarkable. All right, so this is all a build up to studying compressible quantum matter. And why do we want to study it? Well, this is one reason. For example, as I showed you this picture, beautiful picture that just came out in Science from the group of Matsuda on this high temperature superconductor. So it's at low temperatures that have various intensity wave superconducting phases. But here I want to focus on the higher temperature regime, where it was plotted, the color plot is the exponent in the temperature dependent resistivity. So there's a regime out here where it looks like a conventional quantum liquid. The view of what that is embedded. But the mystery is, of course, trying to understand all this other strange behavior where you get highly non-quantum liquid. So my purpose here, I should emphasize, is not to explain this data. My purpose here is simply to understand non-trivial examples of compressible quantum states, of which these are two. I just want to list the ones that we understand, and eventually, hopefully, it will be useful in understanding data like this. Okay. So let me begin with the photon liquid. So the question here, first of all, let me step back a bit. What do we mean by compressible quantum matter? Well, that's exactly what it means. You take some quantum system and define a charge. So what do you mean by a charge? A charge is something that's a conserved quantity. Could be spin, could be electron number. You need to have one conserved quantity. And you want the quantum system to be in a regime where you can smoothly vary the value of that quantity by varying some external parameter. As you vary the chemical potential, you can vary the density of electrons, you add change of pressure, you can smoothly vary at zero temperature the value of that parameter. So if I ask you, give me examples of compressible quantum states, meaning states at zero temperature, okay, which are compressible. You think about it a bit, well, of course. So one example is just a solid. You take a solid and compress it. It's compressible at zero temperature. But I don't want to deal with a solid, because a solid has a broken symmetry. It's a broken tangential symmetry. A Hamiltonian is invariant and it's broken. So when I make a stronger requirement, you don't break tangential symmetry. Then if you think about it a bit, you come up with, well, how about a superfluid? Superfluid helium 4 is compressible. Yes, but that also has a broken symmetry. It's broken the U1 symmetry associated with the conserved charge. So my final challenge to you is give me examples of a compressible state which breaks no symmetry. And in fact, there's only one answer that's the problem. That's fully established. I don't know, there are no fully in dimensions greater than one. But experimentally, it's clear that there's many other examples, and that's what we are working hard to understand. Okay, so let me review the properties of the Fermi liquid. Well, the Fermi liquid is adiabatically connected to the free particle states, and you create the free particle state by just filling up states inside the Fermi state, which has a radius here. And so since each particle must occupy one state, the volume of the area enclosed by this Fermi surface must equal the density of particles. That's called the Luddington relation, and it's obviously true for free particles. So one of the deep results of Fermi liquid theory is that when you turn on interaction, this result doesn't change. And there is a precise way to define where the Fermi surface is, even for non-interacting particles. And it's exactly the same position as for free particles. So that's called the Luddington relation. The volume enclosed by this, VFTD, is proportional to the charge, Q. That's one basic property of Fermi liquid. Then what are the excitations of a Fermi liquid? Well, they're basically just as the same as the free Fermi gas, apart from some unimportant denormalization. So the excitations are you add a particle just above the Fermi surface or remove it just below the Fermi surface. And the energy cost of that, this goes linearly on the distance from the Fermi surface. So you can say the energy goes linearly with Q. And I write in this fancy way, anticipating something later. The Z is just one. Okay, so the Z is what I'm going to call the dynamic exponent, which tells me how the energy scales the distance from the Fermi surface. So what we notice here, of course, is the remarkable feature of the Fermi liquid, is that there are zero energy excitations on a whole line in momentum space. That's really what makes it much harder, more complicated to do that than the conformal field theory. The conformal field theory has zero energy excitations only at one momentum at a point. So they're trivial from the perspective of this kind of thing. And finally, the other property of Fermi liquid you all know is that it's a linear specific. Look at the specific heat, it goes vanishing linearly with temperature. So I'm going to write it in a maximally complicated way. I'm going to say the entropy density for this temperature to power d minus theta over c with theta equals d minus 1. Okay, why am I writing it this way? Well, this is trying to make an analogy with the Stefan-Boltzmann law. So Stefan-Boltzmann law is through the entropy, say, of photons in d dimensions, and you can work that out. Of course, you know the entropy goes as t to the d. Now, if your photons have dispersion, omega is q to the z, you can also work that out as an interesting problem, and you'll find the entropy goes as t to the d over z. All right, so that's the general result for any gapless system in d dimensions with dynamic exponent z. The entropy goes as t to the d over z. Now here, however, you know it goes as t. So we introduce this fudge factor theta, which is called the violation of hyperscaling exponent, which makes this d minus theta equal to 1, and then this works. And so what is the meaning of theta? Theta is simply telling us that at low energies, if I look at the dispersion of the excitations, they only disperse in one dimension. So in other words, they only disperse transverse to the Fermi surface. And there are d dimensions, d minus 1 dimensions around the Fermi surface where they don't disperse. So basically, d minus theta is the effective dimensionality of dispersion, and theta is called the violation of hyperscaling exponent. Okay? there's a reason for introducing all of this, just to get a linear specificity, but this is for your purposes. All right, so that's the full reject query. And this is really all I have to think. Okay, another beautiful property of full reject query only worked out relatively recently is its entanglement entropy. So, you know, the entanglement entropy is what we can use for everything. And this is the basic result, which is believed also to hold for with interaction, but originally established for the earlier. So now it goes, first of all, you get the violation of the area. Now, it's not the linear being that is not proportional to P, it's proportional to P log P. And where does the log P come from? Well, you can really think of that as a consequence of this one dimensionality here. So there's a 1 plus 1 dimensional pair of fermions in here. And remember, there was a log P in entanglement entropy of CFP2s. C over 6 log P. That was the reason I introduced it. So that comes in here for each fermion in every direction. And so because it comes in every direction, you also get this factor P of fermion. It's P log P. It's not just log P. P log P is the leading term. And the coefficient here in two dimensions is just here. The Fermi wave vector for this factor 112 for the case of a circular Fermi surface. So the Fermi surface is circular, but the shape can have any shape you want. And in fact, it's independent of the shape. The coefficient is independent of the shape. And this is really a generic property of any Fermi vector for the circular Fermi surface. There's a generalized formula for any shape of the Fermi surface, but I won't need that. Since I will only have circular Fermi surface.
These kind of materials, they are a continuum of conformal field theories?
Sorry?
These kind of materials, they are, I think, I've done described by a continuum of conformal field theories? Because they are
in some respects, yes. It's like a whole continuum of free one-dimensional parallel fermions. For this formula, that's an invest. That's correct. But if you look at some other properties, there are other properties where you do have to worry about the curvature of the Fermi surface and the dispersion transverse. But for this quantity, all right. So that's the Fermi link. But we are searching for some other examples of compressible states. We understand the Fermi liquid. So I'm going to introduce a few more. Okay. So let's take a bunch of bosons. So let's suppose I take bosons. It's a thing very generally here. And now Q is the number of bosons. If you want to take these bosons and find some way of finding a ground state of these bosons which doesn't break any symmetry. So the two ways we know of taking ground state of bosons would be either form a solid, like KM4, low enough temperatures, or form a superfluid also like KM4. But is there any other way of cooling bosons down to low temperature and not breaking the symmetry and having a finite density of that present in your system? So there is one way, which is actually also seen experimentally, it's kind of a cheat, but anyway, let me mention it. Suppose there were some spectator fermions. Suppose I had a mixture of bosons and fermions. And I want lots of these spectator fermions. So, lithium-6, lithium-7 mixture and boladium, for example. Then each boson B can take a spectator fermion and form a molecule. And that molecule then would be a fermion, which I call C. Okay. And so if there's enough spectator fermions around, each boson can become part of a molecule. But molecules are fermions. Now they don't have the host index. So then I'll get a ground state, ignoring the spectator fermion, because as far as the conservation laws are concerned, it's only the bosons that carry the charge. So the ground state will have a Fermi surface of these molecules. And now you can prove for the system, it's quite an interesting relation, that the area enclosed by this Fermi surface is exactly equal to the density of bosons. So there's a Lebesgue theorem now also for the bosons, as you might naively expect from the picture, because the number of molecules has to be equal to the number of fermions. But this is a very approximate picture, assuming the molecules are all independent of each other, they're not. It's a very complicated many-body state, but you can prove to all orders in the appropriate perturbation theory, that you will then get a Fermi surface whose area is equal to the density of bosons. So there's always Anytime you don't break this U1 symmetry, whether you're talking about both of the fermions, there is a limit here that you have to deal with in regular. And here, of course, you get around it in this simple way, which seems reasonable once you think of it. Okay. All right, is that example clear, everyone?
The limit doesn't work for solid.
Oh, no, I'm assuming it's not broken here. Right. I'm switching here. And also, you can't have a simple fluid component. So the Lattice theorem is there's a one Lattice relation for every U1 surface quantity. As long as it's not broken, there is a
Lattice. But isn't this something just
Lattice with U1? Sure. But I don't think the close connection between conservation laws is independent of if you're talking bosons or fermions. It's also true for bosons. It has to be Lattice theorem for bosons. I think that's new. It wasn't there in the earlier works.
Yeah, but then there's a little one which plays on top of A level quantum years.
Sure.
That's not quite the same thing that you're saying that broken symmetry. Because you might have the possibility that perturbation theory breaks down, but then the symmetry is broken.
Sure. I mean, there can be others. So the question is, are there other states that are not adiabatically connected to the free particles. Here's a relatively simple example because it involves formation of some bound states. But I'm going to give you more non-trivial examples. And in our experience, we found that for every one of those even more exotic states, there is still a relativity of that over. There is, you know, in terms of new degrees of freedom, you can still define a relativity of that. Okay, then the other more exotic form, which appears in certain lattice models, is you take your boson and imagine the boson splits into two fermions. So, okay, this is kind of more mysterious, but we know this kind of fractionalization can happen. The boson becomes two fermions. So, very crudely speaking, your boson operator splits into two fermions. Then you see that I can rotate the fermion by a phase. That fermion to the opposite phase and not change any physical property. So an immediate consequence of some fractionalization like this is that the resulting theory of these two fermions must be a gauge theory, as a local emergent gauge operator. But if you momentarily ignore that gauge theory, then what will these fermions do? Well, they have to form a fermion circuit. There's a whole density of that. The density of F1 fermion, the density of F2 fermion equals the density of boson. Each boson split. So then you'll get Fermi surfaces of the F fermions. And again, the area enclosed by these F fermions must equal the total boson density. And this is again a relationship now you can establish for all orders of perturbation theory, starting not from free particles, but from some weakly coupled gauge theory. You can prove to all orders of the gauge coupling that there is still a density. Using the same techniques as Landau and Lattice, but starting not from the free particle limit. Now, I've drawn this Fermi surface, you know, with a halo. And that's for a reason. Well, that's because to remind you that actually the excitations here, this Fermi surface, are quite different from a Fermi liquid because of the presence of this gauge. And I'll say a bit more about that in a minute. All right, so here's then a first exotic example of a compressible state. Of bosons, which let's call it the Bose metal, but the boson is split into two fermions. Now this new state still has a Fermi surface of the F fermions. You haven't gotten rid of the Fermi surface. But it's not so easy to see, because the F fermions are not physical objects. You can't do a photo imaging experiment just measure an F fermion. And so in some sense the F fermion is a different of your gauge imagination. But it's still there. In some sense. How are you going to see it? Well, that's of course one of the difficult questions you're facing. But one way you might see it is by measuring the analog of Fredel oscillate. Suppose you measure the response of the system to impurity equals the response of oscillate at this 2 PM wavelength. And that would be a signature, telltale signature that you can think this Fermi surface exists, even though you can't see it in a photo emission type experiment. Alright, so this is why I call these Fermi surfaces hidden. Because they're a little harder to see, but in they're very well defined set theory there. They're not just the gate artifact. But they're real in the sense that they can be observed in higher correlations.
So what's the coupling between the impurity and the, how does it couple to the boson, for example?
Just the density of bosons, any impurity. So the Hamiltonian is only in terms of bosons. It's just the Bose-Hubbard model of ring exchange stuff. And so this paper has an example of the Hamiltonian. It's just V dagger, VVI, it's just a boson Hamiltonian, period. But it has a ground state, which looks like part of the 2-Fermi surface. And we have other examples of this. All right, so that's possibility number two, which I referred to as a Bose metal or an NFL, or non-Fermi liquid. And it's, you know, it's a relatively new phase of matter that has been discussed, but there's increasing evidence that it is the present and stable in two dimensions and also higher dimensions. Okay. And the final state I want to introduce is just a simple linear combination of these two. We call FL star. So these bosons can do both of these things at the same time. Some of the bosons could fractionalize, others could capture the spectator fermion in the form of regular Fermi surface. And for this system, then there'll be a Lyapunov theorem. The sum of these areas now must equal the density of the boson, just as you intuitively might expect in a free particle. Okay, so to summarize, these are the three states: FL, FL star, NFL, and FL star. And there's many models and many field theories where you can argue quantum lattice models and so on, where you can argue analog of these states. Just kind of presented in a very general and simplest possible context after many trial and error, much trial and error, what the best way to talk about it. So let me know if this worked. Any questions? Okay, how am I doing on time? Oh, great. Okay, perfect. All right, so now I'm ready to. Actually, I'm not ready yet. I'm not ready to start a lot with you on this. So let me here just summarize the basic three properties of the Fermi liquid. The Lattice relation, V equals 1 in the Fermi surface, this relation and the entanglement. Okay, the entropy and the entanglement. Very basic one. So now let me take this Bose metal, which is this state here. This bunch of fermions coupled to a mutual. Okay, so this is a problem that we've studied in various guises over the years, over the last 25 years, starting with, I would say, work of Pincus and Freisler and Patrick Lee and Sharon Ware and many others. And let me just summarize what we have learned from all of this. So first of all, there is indeed, even in the system, even when you include the gauge field, there is a well-defined sense of the work of here. It can really define very precisely. And it also obeys the Lyapunov relation. But this is the same. So one key difference is that these sharp excitations, which Landau said were presented from the surface, which dispersed with Z equals 1, disappear. You get very diffuse excitations, they're not sharp at all. And they have a exponent, which as best as we know, the three-loop computations by Max, building on some work by subsequently, is 3/2. So there's no correction in pulse to the Z equals 3/2. We don't know if it's exact, but just remember that value. So this is, you know, one of the first instances where you have a well-defined field theory strongly coupled field theory with Z not equal to 1. Okay, but then the other two properties, now suddenly there's a payoff for all of this work that I introduced all of this. They work exactly the same way. This still works with the field value of Z, and this also is numerically seems to work for this both metal. Yeah.
Looks, I remember for the U1 gauge field, is that Z equals 3 or
okay.
A different
so I'm defining Q this way, transverse to the Fermi surface.
Yeah.
The Z equals 3 is defined with respect to tangent to the Fermi surface. It's the same as Z equals 3, just a question of how you
define it. Oh, I see. Okay.
This is Z fermion as opposed to Z boson, and Z fermion is always half of Z boson. But this is the more natural, I think this is actually important when I go to the holography. I think it's fundamentally a fermionic theory. That's where the Lorentz gets. The boson is just a composite of the fermions. So I think it's better to think of them for this. Okay, so that's the summary of, well, not quite. One more. So why don't we declare victory? This sounds like a nice theory. And you just say, yeah, it's solved, and let's go and fit all the data. But one of the reasons we don't declare victory is because it's very important observation by Sansiklie, who showed that when you look at higher order beyond two and three loops, the expansion that you have, which in all cases just some 1/n expansion, actually breaks down, that you make additional infrared divergences, and you have some really infinite set of graphs, even at first order 1/n. We show that it was even worse when you had n over points. And anyway, so this problem becomes much, much harder than QCD or any other problem that I've seen in physics, really. In field theory, that's it. It's a strongly coupled field theory. We don't know how to put all this together. Okay, so we're going to try one off. So let's go back to the order field. Let's go to the same sort of argument. So now I'm going to say I want a different z. So let's look at the boundary theory contained in the zeta to z. And now the proper distance, instead of letting it be invariant, I'm going to say it's a covariant. And I'm going to put this theta here again, the violation of hyperscaling exponent, anticipating that that's what it's going to be when I compute. So let's say I look for a metric that has this problem. So of course, when theta equals 0 and z equals 1, I get conformal. So if I give you this relation and ask you to determine the most general metric, okay, this is two lines of elementary algebra, we'll give you some solution up through some reparametrization invariant. It's not terribly important what the solution is, just remember this is where it came from.
So,
yeah.
How do you get this metric? How do you get it to use?
Exactly what I just said. It's really a two-line calculation. I give you this requirement, and I want you to write on the most general metric consistent with spatial translation invariance, time translation invariance, time reversal symmetry, and it has this property and the rescaling of factorization. So first of all of those additional requirements means you can only take dt squared, dr squared, dx squared, and multiply by some powers of r. So you have three powers of r, one here, one here, and one here. And you have two conditions. Okay, so that fixes two of them. And the third one actually is arbitrary because you have reparameterization invariance in r. So once you use reparameterization invariance in r, which I use arbitrary, you have to make one choice. But that's perfectly okay, that's part of gravity. Everything will be parameterization variance in that direction. All right, so let's take this metric and compute a few things. So if I give you a metric, what are the things you can compute? Well, one of the things you can compute is area. Metric is the area. And one of the fundamental results of gravity is that area equals entropy. Go back to Bekenstein and Hawking. So with this metric, you can now raise the temperature a little bit, and you can do some scaling arguments that I won't go into. Again, there are just three or four lines. The kind of scaling arguments people are predicting phenomena have no trouble with. And from that scaling argument, and using the Bekenstein Hawking relation that basically entropy is area of horizon, you'll get the entropy density is exactly what I said it should be for a Fermi liquid. So now there's a payoff to all this complicated way of writing the specific heat. It has exactly this form. So this tells me that if I have some holographic theory that is describing a compressible state with a Fermi surface hidden or not, this theta should be d minus 1. So now, of course, ideally, I would start with some holographic description and really work really hard and derive theta. Nobody's done that yet. So we're just going to put it by hand equal to d minus 1 and see what else comes up. So ultimately, you'd like to do that, of course. Yeah.
And your little, you know, race temperature, there's a black hole, so the metric should have changed. You
yeah.
do the same thing.
Yeah. How right. So, well, basically, right. So, I want to see if the argument is a little bit good. So we don't know, we don't have to determine the full metric to determine the power.
I see.
So here you have some metric going forever. And this is the direction R. Now you raise the temperature. Okay. So there'll be some horizon at some point R sub H. What's the area of the horizon? Well, the area of the horizon.
Okay. So just a cut there. That's a simple
but,
area,
you don't know, there's some horizon. Okay, it's not cutting it. What's the area of the horizon? Well, the metric was dx squared over r squared.
Okay.
So the area of the horizon is 1 over rh to the b. But there's a factor of 1 over r for every spatial direction. But that's not, then you have to ask, how does rh scale with temperature? So it must diverge with temperature with some power. As temperature goes to zero, RH goes to zero. So how must it diverge? Well, again, you look at scaling. Temperature is inverse time, scales with Z. R scales with this. That's the obvious. Okay, so now we fix theta equals D minus 1 and try to figure out what kind of space you get. So now there's one more. Now it turns out, and this is really, to me, the most amazing thing about the story. Any theory of gravity described in the flow of gravity space must satisfy something called the non-energy condition. I never heard of it, but it's some stability condition for gravity, and it's crucial to all the area theorems that help you prove for general relativity. They all rely on this positivity condition. So if here I know the metric. So once I know the metric, I know the Einstein tensor. And then Einstein's equation is gv nu equals t mu. So I know the stress energy tensor. It's so easy to figure out what the non-energy condition is. So you apply it to this theory, which is exponent z and theta, and you get this inequality. This is believed to be an exact inequality for some strongly coupled theory, which is described by this holographic model. So, and presumably also for this Bose-Mandel. Now, you know, I define z and theta for the Bose-Mandel, I define them here. Define exactly what they were in terms of the dispersion and the entropy. And these are quantities that appear in the field theory. But so far, no one has ever, in all of this analysis of the 405 loops, ever come up with a reason why such an inequality should be true. Maybe somebody will eventually. But this comes out very simply from the theory of gravity. And you can view it as some sort of necessary condition that your bounding theory has a simple holographic description. Z must be bigger than 1 over theta. But now the most amazing thing is that now you put theta equals d minus 1, d equals 2, and you get z greater than 3 halves, you get the same value 3 halves of the lower bound that I've been obtained from initially first by Patrick Lee, I think, for the Gates field coupled Fermi surface problem. So that's really amazing. You're getting out of purely analysis, purely through the gravity, you're getting this highly non-trivial exponent as a lower bound that appears from some many body theory of Fermi surface. Okay. Is this an accident or not? I don't know, but I think it's significant, but we'll see. Yeah.
So this stability condition for gravity, does it mean so for the classical gravity or for the quantum?
This is all classical gravity.
I see. So
really
the question it. Whether quantum correction may change this bound, or whether there's, say, maybe this even true, you include the quantum fluctuation of gravity.
My guess would be there would be no correction.
It's believed that including all quantum correction, as long as you average the known condition over basically were a region, even the fluctuations, basically the energy can be time with certain violations. But besides that, I believe this is an exact same.
There's a reason to say this may be even valid for quantum.
Yeah. I mean, you should view the, you know, the effective gravity theories in a similar way you view the, say, the chiral model of broken symmetry or some non-integral model. You know, there's all kinds of exact relations that follow from just the classical analysis of the effective and non-integral model. I think it's something like that. You can always, as long as this is, you normalize to the effective theory of the smallest number of derivatives, and that's Einstein gravity. Okay. And then finally, one more thing you can do is compute the entanglement entropy. So I have a metric, I have the real-time Inagi formula, and so with the help of Brian and Lisa, you'll go and solve some critical equations, and out comes very beautifully this result. It's P log P, as you want. And the coefficient, which scales with exactly the way you'd expect for a floating surface, in this case, proportional to Kx. And in a way, that's insensitive to all kinds of UV. So it seems like then what have I done so far is I've described in purely boson electron. This is just a vector in empty space, really, some dual of a theory of the Fermi surface, of a strongly interacting theory of the Fermi surface. At least that's the claim. So let me make a picture of it. So this is you know, an explicit model I give you the solution. You take Einstein gravity, and then you add a dilaton field phi, and also an electromagnetic field F. Now the rules of the correspondence is that for every conserved charge Q, there is a U1 gauge field, and the mean electric flux going out this way, or at least there's a Gauss's law, the electric flux emerging from a boundary space is equal to charge density. So you put that constraint in and solve this for certain choices for the dilaton potential. So there are these exponents here, alpha and theta, and they're just related to theta and z. So alpha beta can be anything at this point. I can choose any value of theta or z, and I'll get a solution, which will indeed be exactly at this point. So you give me theta and z, then there's a model which is the IR with a very general form of the empty phi, which will have that as a solution, which will obey this result. And have electric flux starting from here, going all the way out to infinity. So the way we think about this is that you have some matter here, some bosons. The bosons are fractionalized. And these fractionalized fermions form the Fermi surface, but you can't see it. It's somewhere deep in the IR, it's hidden. Let's call these fermions quarks. So they're way past the horizon. And all of the electric flux, like Gauss's law that you have here, goes all the way out to infinity. And this is our claim, this is what is the bosonization. This is the theory that we got to the structure that bosonizes this strongly coupled boson. Shouldn't you call it a boson? It's a Fermi surface coupled to the
So,
yes.
So, how does the dilaton field behave in the infrared?
Well, it diverges logarithmically.
So that means this classical vector breaks down.
Probably something. Well, so in fact, the boundary case when z is equal to 3/2, it doesn't diverge. That's a paper by Shakulian. So, but I think you have a different opinion on that, right? So this.
Yeah, I would disagree with that statement.
Oh, is that right? Okay. So Shakulian made a mistake.
Yeah, I'd say it's basically just Gauss's law. You've written down the theory with a conserved charge.
Yes.
And you could, in theory, you could hide this inside a black hole, but if you don't put a black hole, there's nowhere for the charge to go, so the only thing you can have is a singularity.
Okay, there is a singularity, but is it a bad singularity as far as quantum corrections are concerned?
Well, I would say in most cases, yes, there might be some cases that it looks dicey.
Well, I would say on the field theory side, our intuition is the same. That in most cases, these systems are unstable to pairing. Only in some select cases with the U1 gauge theory with enough bare repulsion can be stabilized the theory against pairing. So it's probably true that this state, ultimately, in most cases, is not stable, which may also be true in gravitational theory. But I think what would be very nice to determine is the energy scale of these things are happening, so then that would give us some idea of what the regimes are. I agree. So we don't know whether this whole thing is stable or not. Yeah.
How Q enters your metric?
Q.
Supposedly, you know, Q is representing density.
Yeah.
So they should also enter the metric so the entanglement I error should depend on Q, you know.
That's what our paper is about. So it turns out it only determines the coefficient of this curve is fixed by Q. At least in like our game first. So some coefficients are fixed by Q, other are not. So initially when you look at it, it looks like the Q appears in a really complicated way, everywhere. But when you compute the entanglement entropy, you find it's insensitive to most of it, except the part that has a fixed dependence on Q.
But the trouble is very simple. In your metric, there's no Q there.
I am aware. Sorry, there's a prefactor here, and a prefactor here, and a prefactor here that put equals 1.
Oh, I see.
There are several pages of algebra involved in getting those prefactors. And I see. They all depend on Q. They depend on the boundary conditions. But fortunately, when you put it all together, when you compute the entanglement entropy, which is the invariant quantity, everything else is a gate choice. It has just this few dependence. This was a surprise, and the field theorists who studied this didn't even bother looking for this. The only reason we looked for it because we had the idea that this should be have a universal dependent Q because it's the entanglement entropy. And indeed, it turned out it magically worked out. So it's something called the attractor mechanism that people think they know, that some version of the attractor mechanism comes here to rescue the Leibniz theorem and give you the right Q to Leibniz. All right, so that's this kind of picture of this compressible state. So now, what about the other two states I introduced? I talked about this F of star, the combination of regular quantum liquid and non-quantum liquid. What is that? Well, that's, in fact, a solution. That solution looks something like this. You have to introduce some additional fermions. And those fermions live in some intermediate chain, roughly speaking. And so now the electric flux going out to infinity is partially screened by these fermions. And so now this state, with some flux going to infinity, some screened by these states, is what I would call an F of star state. So these are the regular Fermi surface, and that's the hazy Fermi surface of the state. And in fact, the original work of I guess starting with Sun-Sik Lee and Yu Mabrili and Wei and others, all were recognized at that time. I think it's better to say we're talking about this state. They were measuring these fermions, which stay only part of the flux, and they're more likely most of the flux. It's hidden behind over. And we are refocusing attention. I mean, to us, the most interesting thing is really what's going on here. What are these parts? And then you can take the natural logical limit of this, where all of the fermions are the electric field is zero and thing is terminated. And that's a Fermi liquid. And for this you can prove Leibniz theorem and everything else. So to summarize, this holographic description gives you two things. First, it gives you a way of measuring entanglement by seeing how the metric behaves out of infinity. And then, by measuring the electric flux, whether electric flux goes out to infinity or not, it tells you whether you have fractionalization. Electric flux going past the horizon is the analog of fractionalization. And when you put it all that idea together, the Gauss's law, you get Leibniz theorem. So Leibniz theorem really pops up of this analysis in a nice way. From solving the Einstein's equation. Quite amazing. All right, that's what I have to say. So I started with gap quantum matter and told you to start paying attention to the entanglement because a lot of exciting things are happening both in theory and experiments. There's also a lot of work on finite temperature dynamics of conformal field theories near conformal fixed points, which I didn't say much about at all. And I focused on the fact that the holographic theory, is giving us now examples of compressible states. And amazingly, those compressible states are in one-to-one correspondence with the three types of states that we've seen from field theory, which are these non-quantum liquids, fractionalized quantum liquids, ordinary quantum liquids. It would be fantastic if the holographic theory gave an entirely new type of compressible state that we hadn't dreamed of. That may yet happen, but I haven't seen it yet.